We do have a quorum, so I'll call the meeting of the Health Policy and Finance Committee to order. For members and for those with us today, because we're a little surprised, the Senate decided not to do what we thought they were going to do on the mental health bill, so they are here now, and we need some of those people here with us, so we're going to skip around a bit. We're going to first of all do House File 3692, Representative Powell, which is Department Health Policy Bill. Representative Powell, with that notice to people, moves House File 3692, and I believe this is a policy bill that would be able to go to the General Register.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding.
Representative Powell moves House File 3692 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. Representative Powell, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. There are 10 sections to this bill. It's a rather thin, skinny policy bill. There are a couple sections where you may want to take some close look at. But I will go through them one by one. Very generally, I have Charles Sadlack from the department to back me up on this. So Section 1 has to do with the circumcision law, the changes needed to comply with federal law, which does not recognize, quote, religious practice, unquote, to serve as grounds for allowing or disallowing a service or a payment. Section 2 is a change that would allow transportation service for pharmacy visits for dual-eligible clients. Section 3 and 8 have the same changes. It provides for the last four digits of the Social Security number for identification instead of the full Social Security number. Section 4 is a technical correction and a citation and provides proper terminology for relocation services. Section 5 updates language to make it conform with federal definitions, and this change is related to Section 9. Section 6 concerns last year's program integrity initiatives and is meant to strengthen legislative intent. Section 7 requires that county agencies pay a set per-person premium on the GAMC clients transitioning into Minnesota Care, and this would simplify administration of this new law that we enacted last year, and it is revenue neutral. Section 9 provides the commissioner discretion on whether to accept a county-based purchasing proposal that would displace existing managed care arrangements in order to become the only health care plan available to enrollees. And Section 10 repeals an outdated subdivision. That is a general overlook of this bill. If there's any specific questions on that, Charles Sadlack is here from the Department of Human Services. Oh, also, Mr. Chairman, I am reminded I do have a federal amendment.
Okay, you identify that for us.
Page 6, line 31. Apparently, Mr. Chen found this this problem. After $7.10, we need to cross out for each and replace that with beginning the. So the new language now would read a premium of $7.10 beginning the month described in section and so on.
Representative Powell moves to amend House File 3692 on line 6.31. After $7.10, strike for each and replace it with beginning the. You all understand that oral amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're ready for questions.
Any questions from members for clarification? I do want to offer an opportunity for testimony as well.
Certainly.
If members wanted to wait for that. So why don't we do that? I think there's nothing more for clarification. Is there anyone that wishes to testify regarding House File 3692? Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed with your testimony after introducing yourself.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Patricia Coldwell, and I work with the Association of Minnesota Counties. I would like to voice our opposition to a couple of sections, language in a couple of the sections in the bill, Section 5 and Section 9. I think you probably have heard concerns from counties regarding county-based purchasing. These sections propose changes to the ways in which counties can participate in county-based purchasing, and particularly they speak to the issues of choice and access to services. The proposal indicates that the Department of Human Services should be allowed to require choice of health care managed care organization in rural areas in Minnesota. As I think that many of you know, county-based purchasing has been shown to be an effective model to integrate health care and social services in those counties that are participating right now. Counties have reinvested savings in the community and prevention activities. South Country Health Alliance in particular, and Prime West Health Systems and IM Care, the three county-based purchasing entities, have shown good success. They've performed at the top of all the managed care entities in their HEDIS indicators, which is a measurement of health outcomes. What happens in this language is that that choice in section... Section 5, page 6. Where am I? Under Section 5, this indicates that the commissioner can require competition if it could substantially employ an enrollee's choice of managed care organizations. We think the important issue here speaks to choice of provider, excuse me, rather than choice of managed care organizations. We think that when this language was first adopted, that the language care systems was intended to refer more to choice of provider. And we think that in particularly in rural Minnesota, that's what's most important to consumers. So we oppose changing this to managed care organizations, and we oppose the issue of requiring choice of managed care organizations. In section 9, lines 723 through 728, it really reverses language that was passed last year and was considered in a conference committee that the commissioner should not reject a county-based purchasing plan when it can be shown that it doesn't limit an enrollee's choice of services. Instead, it allows the commissioner to consider that, so it achieves exactly the opposite effect. So, again, we think that the issue of choice is really related to choice of provider rather than choice of health plan, and we think that this language would severely impair the ability of new counties to enter into this arrangement, which has really been a pretty innovative kind of arrangement for providing services and assuring services for public programs in greater Minnesota up to this point.
Ms. Holder, if I may, and I think you know that I have long-standing record of being supporter and even early authorship in county-based purchasing.
Mm-hmm.
I do wonder, I mean, in Section 9, it doesn't mean that you can't, it just sort of, there's a consider language, and while I was a part of this when this happened in conference committee, it never quite felt right to me, and I do think that we need to be mindful of competition and access, not just at provider levels, but even from a health plan's point of view. And that, in general, I welcome the notion. There are instances, I think, where kind of what might be single source should be considered because of the geography, whatever else it may be, the kind of population centers. But in the general notion, it's hard for me to not wish for opportunities for competition. And I'm wondering why you would be worried about it, because I think the counties that do this do a wonderful job and have been an opportunity for, when it makes sense, for there to be competition at the health plan level would be healthy to the marketplace.
Mr. Chair, I believe that counties understand that perspective. We may have a different value or different emphasis on the value of competition. One of the things that I've heard our members say is that it's really not a level playing field in this area. For example, my understanding is that the department contract requirements place really strong limits on how much any health plan, including county-based purchasing, can advertise or market for their public programs, and the county-based purchasing entities, for the most part, only do public programs. And so what that means is they are not able to get their name out and advertise to the same extent as a larger health plan, who might do so for the purposes of their commercial market, but that has a lot of spillover effect. So that, I guess that's one issue. In a sense, it's really not a level playing field. I guess the other issue is just in terms of where is it most important to put the dollars, and counties in county-based purchasing have chosen to put their dollars into services for clients, case management, and then reinvesting in integration.
Well, thank you. I think you presented the case well. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify regarding this? Please come forward. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator, Representative. My name is Jim Fisabilla. I'm the CEO of Prime West Health System, a county-based purchasing organization serving 10 rural counties in West Central and Southwestern Minnesota. We're headquartered in Alexandria, Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. Really, I'd like to kind of go through. There's a couple of things that cause concern to me in terms of the proposed language changes to this. And it really starts with the section 9. First of all, when this went into the black box of the omnibus last year, it went in not intended to be just a county-based purchasing as a potential single plan, but to allow the single plan option for any health plan that participates in the state. I believe that's a competitive, very much a competitive mode at the health plan level, because it forces the plans to put their best foot forward at the proposal level and then stick to it, or the contract will be re-upped and there will be another competition. As far as competition among providers, and I'm going to speak specifically to rural areas, since that's what I'm most familiar with, there is no such thing. You are set with one hospital, one, maybe two clinics, one nursing home, and to have a plan say that we have them in our network, the next plan is going to say, I have them in my network. You are not necessarily aligning plans with care systems where you try to use the competitive edge to bring down healthcare costs. You're faced with one set of providers that all the plans have access to. The next part of that is really in a public program paradigm where there's pretty much X dollars to use toward this, with the floor in terms of the cost of healthcare being set by the DHS fee for service rate. There's not a whole lot of negotiations you can do in terms of provider pricing. Pretty much all the plans are around the same rate that they offer for provider reimbursement. So those types of things that we value in terms of the private market do not necessarily hold true in the public program paradigm. So keep that in mind when we talk about the word competition. I believe when you have the ability, not the mandate, but the ability to have a choice of multiple plans or a single plan option in a county, you are forcing competition at the plan level for efficient use of the healthcare dollar, for the integration of resource at the local level. You are forcing us to compete to one another with a chance we may either get this market or not get this market, regardless if we're county-based purchasing or a private health plan. Section 9 really is a moot point since it circles back to Subdivision 6. The notwithstanding statement at the very beginning of Section 9 basically says, if this language stands, while the commissioner can consider county-based purchasing option, you circle back to Subdivision 6 and it says, basically there has to be a choice of more than one MCO, managed care organization. So really this particular section really has no weight at all and could actually be deleted if you hold on to the previous subdivision. The words in Section 9, sole source, should be struck. That language would find itself at odds with federal law and competitive procurement. So single plan is the more accurate language. Whether it shall not reject, if that struck, or consider, those are semantics, and again a moot point because really it's notwithstanding the previous subdivision. The issue goes back to the managed care organizations in Subdivision 6. Which basically requires a choice of MCOs, managed care organizations. If we put this one in place, we're trying to trump the BBA of 1997. The federal government is fairly explicit in stating that it is a preference for choice of health plans, but does have a protection for rural counties where they stipulate the choice really is among providers, ensuring choice of providers and not health plans necessarily. I would like to see that protection preserved and left in the hands of the commissioner and the counties that decide on what's the best proposal. Let's take this a step further if this stays in play and this is passed as written. You'll have multiple counties or multiple plans proposing to serve a county with 500 members. The law will basically guide the commissioner that there has to be multiple plans serving this county. That means the plan does not necessarily have to put its best foot forward. By default, they'll probably be selected. So we have 500 members who use essentially the same hospital or the same clinic, and the same hospital and the same clinic now has to decide, okay, this is member is part of this plan. Do I require a service authorization from this service? No, wait, that's the other plan that requires that. And do I submit this form to this plan on a HICPA 1500 or a UV92? Or if it's a hospital, do I have to give them a prior notification prior to admission, or is it prompt notification, depending on the plan? Your providers are just bogged down in any county where there's multiple health plans serving. And they do all this work trying to figure it out, and God forbid if the member forgets to bring their eligibility card. But they're faced with this, that I have to figure out which plan has this rule or this policy, or it's in this contract provision, so I can submit a claim for a service that costs me a dollar and get reimbursed 30 cents. These types of things will actually scare our providers away from serving this vulnerable population. Again, if we keep competition at the proposal level by the health plans, we have competition. The competition is not among providers in rural communities. There just simply isn't multiple providers in rural communities. There's a lot to consider here. There's another point to be made, and that's the timeliness of the entire application process for when a county wants to opt to take a look at the other plan availabilities. There's a time frame. But if the language did not change right now, there's no county that's prepared to act on this particular piece of legislation as it stands without the changes right now. The time frame is not there. The commissioner has up to 2 years, 15 months to 2 years to decide. So no county is in a position to act. What I would suggest is that DHS, the health plans, the counties, and the county-based purchasing organizations get together and find compromise language to propose to this body and the Senate of something that agrees and preserves competition at all levels, but recognizes the differences between rural and urban, and is consistent with the federal law of 1997. I don't believe we need to rush in to make a change on this. We could soften the language to make sure that the single plan could include other health plans as an option rather than just county-based purchasing. But I do believe we do not need to hurry in this decision. There's a lot at stake. Rural providers should be brought into this. Members should be brought into the discussion, the enrollee themselves. But right now, I'm afraid this is on a fast track, and there's a lot of politics at play, and there's a lot of ramifications that have not been studied, and arguments that have been hashed and rehashed since the mid-90s regarding county-based purchasing and PMAP, and now we throw in Medicare and the special needs programs. There's a lot that needs to be thought about, and a lot of serious dollars on the table. And at the end, if we don't do this right, the ones that will really lose are the people we're trying to serve, and preserving those providers in rural areas who are really struggling to make ends meet to serve this vulnerable population. So I would urge caution and study. We do have time. Thank you very much.
Mr. Zola, Mr. Chairman, I just need a little bit of clarification. When you were near the beginning of your comments, you were talking about Section 9. Were you referring back to Section 6?
There would be wherever it's referred back into. I'm sorry. There's a circle back, notwithstanding.
I recall, I think you were just the first phrase in there, subdivision.
It's subdivision 6.
I don't think it's six, not 6 in the bill.
Right, yeah,
current law subdivision.
Yeah, subdivision 6 of the county-based purchasing section of the PMAP law.
Very good. Thank you. That answers it.
Mr. Pinder, I think he's referring to Section 5, subdivision 6.
Well, I was going to ask if we can have somebody from the department. I don't read it.
It is actually Section 5, Subdivision 6, as written. You will see in this, I believe, if the lines are still the same, line 6.1, you will see that care systems is scratched, and the term managed organization is put there. And I don't think managed organization is actually in state definition right now. And care systems actually is probably a fairly careless term, too, because that actually has a different definition than provider. Care system actually has an integrated meaning.
I think, Mr. Pissarro, I think that's a fair point on the terminology in Section 5, and I think that deserves a visit. On the other, though, the way I read it was a little different. It didn't seem to me that the reference back to that notwithstanding precluded the possibility of there being single plan. I thought that Section 9 actually provides for the possibility through the commissioner to have single plan.
What I was reading on that, Representative, is the impair the choice of managed care organization when reasonable choice is available. And if there are multiple plans bidding for a county, reasonable choice would be available to have multiple plans serve a county. And then there's one other point I'd like to make that I don't know if this has been studied on that, and it ties into the very next section. When we talk about, or actually the very previous sentence, impair the state's ability to purchase health care services in other areas, this is actually setting up a situation where a health plan can say to the state, if you don't give me this, I won't serve that. And that situation has cropped up. And that's what we face with some of these, just the very delicate language balance between words care system provider and managed care organization.
Well, fair point. Thank you for your testimony. This is any further questions of the testifier? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the committee. I'd like to proceed with testimony. Identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Karen Pete. I'm a manager in the healthcare purchasing area for the Department of Human Services. I just would like to clarify the language in Section 5. What Section 5 is intended to do is not to, as the previous witness suggested, to trump the federal law. This language was drafted prior to federal regulation being promulgated. The term managed care organization is a defined term in federal law. It has specific meaning, and it is in the regulation that governs managed care purchasing for Medicaid. So I think that it's clearly defined. All of the health plans, including the county-based purchasing organizations that we contract with for state public programs, do meet the definition of the term managed care organization. And this, although I understand some of the concern that exists around this change, this actually brings our statute in line with the federal regulation.
Oh, thank you for the clarification. Are there any further testifiers to this bill? Do you know one? Is there any questions among members? Representative Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Powell, I remember last year when we made the move in getting rid of unnecessary circumcision and the provision in Section 1 as it relates to special circumstances for religious individuals. And from my understanding, there's nothing in federal law, so the department has asked that change. I have a few different questions around that. Does the department look into what other federal exceptions there are, and if so, what are they?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, Kathleen Cota has joined us to get into the specifics of this issue.
Ms. Cota?
Madam Chair and Representative Walker, I'm not aware that we inquired about other situations. The federal government was very clear, however, that we can't base whether you can or can't have something on a religious status.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much money are we saving from disallowing any circumcisions?
Madam Ms. Chair, Porter. Representative Walker, I'm not sure what that figure was last year.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, do you? Okay, we'll try to look it up. I'm thinking it was
I don't know, a few hundred thousand or something like that.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While we're looking that up, you know, I realize that we have limitations as it relates to what we decide to fund and things of that nature, but I do understand special circumstances, especially in the Jewish and the Muslim community. And I do know how strongly individuals feel about this, and not everyone has the financial means. And one of my, you know, I'd be afraid to see if we'll end up with some butcher clinics, and some might say that that's not a possibility. But when it comes down to religion and practice, people are willing and to do almost anything, even if it's not safe to do it. And I just want to bring caution for the record that there is the possibility if individuals are on fixed incomes and don't have means to financially afford to get that $120 circumcision for their child, that we just may see many home clinics popping up where our babies are being circumcised in an unhealthy, sanitary, and unsafe manner.
Thank you. There being no further discussion, Representative Paul renews his motion that House File 3692, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Okay. Sorry, Mr. Allen, we were looking for you and didn't see you right away. So let's move into, is Representative Emmer? Okay, Representative Emmer, let's bring back up, we'll pull off the table House File 3630 that we had discussion. Members recall, I believe that the motion before us was, let's see, this one has money, so this would is being considered for possible inclusion. We did have three additional testifiers that I offered the chance, and I believe all of them have provided information, sent me notes saying that they appreciated the offer, but they didn't feel a requirement to testify. So we've concluded testimony. I think now we would open it up for discussion with the committee. Is there any discussion to House File 3630?
Mr. Chair, do you want to do amendments? You want just discussion?
Well, first discussion, I think, and then we'll take up amendments.
Mr. Chair, I'll discuss.
There's no discussion?
No,
we're ready to take an amendment.
Let me just discuss the whole thing, and then I'll take up the amendments.
Right.
This is just conceptually to the whole bill. And you've heard some concerns, Mr. Chair and members. There's some very nice things about this bill, and there's some very dangerous things about the bill. You've heard about concern about maintenance of effort by the counties, especially at a time when all this case management, federal cuts, and the DACRA business. I'm pretty well convinced this is going to give a significant new burden to counties if the bill were implemented in its current state. Amongst those parts are the counties are not liable for services covered by the new health benefits that are provided, but if it's not clear what's not provided, they're liable for those additional health benefits, and even though the money's taken away. We're establishing some new children's mental health grants, which is a very good thing, but as these county pressures continue, those will be the very programs that will be cut from the county programs. And in my experience in my county, they try very hard to provide family mental health, family counseling, and family services like that. But those are the ones that are, they become kind of elective, so I'm concerned about that. And the talking about giving the county the chance to pay 50% of these RTC services and other such implies as a choice. In many cases, I wonder if the amendment addresses part of that, but even in those that remain, the only choice that exists is that there's no place to send them to in the community services. In my county in particular, there are some services that where these folks are being placed, but even the support services in the context of those people who are out, who have a place to live, are very mean. And these folks are, I think, great risk of just having a bad experience because they don't have, it's all patchwork. And so the more we turn people out of the RTCs, and it's the ongoing discussion we've had before, so I'm concerned, and my final concern, Mr. Chair, which I think is even the most substantive on a policy basis, is as we add mental health benefits to Minnesota Care, which is a commendable goal, we now have created a benefit set which is richer than most private, than most group coverages. And so this is going to create a disincentive for people to want to enroll in a group plan, which we talked about the concern about eroding it, and now they would be inclined to want to go to Minnesota Care, which will further erode the group systems, which is already under substantial erosion concern. So those are my concerns, Mr. Chair.
Emma, I didn't offer you a chance. There was considerable testimony and some concerns expressed. Did you have anything that you wanted to respond to? I'm not saying I have to. I want to be sure that I offer you that opportunity.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity. No.
Thank you. Representative Abel, would you like to offer an amendment?
I would, Mr. Chair, and if the witnesses can get on to talk about it. This has been worked out with the department, and I believe they're comfortable, and rather than me just kind of stumble through it, I'll let, if they're here.
Let's be sure, first of all, we know what...
This is the AO6-1414X.
Okay, Representative Abel offers the amendment AO6-1414X. Members have that in your packet?
Yeah, just to be more brief, I'll just let them talk about it, Mr. Chair.
Okay, is there someone that would like to put the committee through amendment AO6-1414X? Welcome. Please introduce yourself as you begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kate Lerner. I am the director of MACSA, the Association for County Social Service Directors. The amendment that's before you, the 1414X, is put together with the intent to ensure that counties have are not responsible for paying for an increased county share when they do not have control over when an individual is discharged from certain facilities. And that really is the primary intent behind this amendment.
Ms. Mumford, do you have something to add, or are you here for backup?
Nope, I'm just here in case there's other questions.
Okay.
We're tagging today.
Representative Emmer, do you have any reaction to that?
Actually, we do. I want Don Allen to respond, but I'd like to offer an oral amendment to the amendment.
Well, why don't you offer it, and let's see whether Representative Abel is willing to incorporate.
At at line 1.13, after the word treatment, add the words... at a hospital level of care. And then when you're ready, Mr. Allen will address the amendment and the proposed amendment to the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I believe that is the intent. I believe the county folks on a nod or something that clarifies
okay.
it.
Okay, so Representative Abel will incorporate then in amendment AO6-1414X on line 1.13 after the word treatment, add the words at a hospital level of care. Have that correct? Mr. Allen, now to the member, would you like to comment, please?
Chairman Bradley, I think just two comments. Number one, that this amendment does have a fiscal impact. And then number two, that the original bill as it stood had treated the community behavioral health hospitals and the regional treatment centers differently because there are different levels of Medicaid eligibility for people placed in them. That said, we are okay with this amendment if this is the way the counties would like it.
Mr. Allen, I realize that there may not be a specific chance, but you said there's a fiscal impact. Do you have any sort of order of magnitude as to how much that might be?
Chairman Bradley, I do not have an exact figure. I would think that it would probably be at least half of the amount shown on the, or roughly half of the amount shown on the spreadsheet. So I think on the order of $2 million a year, something like that, in 08 and 09.
Mr. Chair.
And
so the fiscal part, fiscal note shows income received from the counties. I think it's a million some in the first year or two, and then 3 million some in the outlying. I think the point of this amendment, and it either shows that the magnitude of impact on the counties in a net sense, And we have to decide if we're going to do that or not. At least this would be a policy decision that we don't intend to let counties be charged for people who are there beyond their control. And that's the point of it. And so I know there's a fiscal impact, Mr. Chair. So I'll leave it at that for now.
Yeah, it seems to me that, as you've explained, the policy, that probably sounds fair. The business about county impact is one of the things I've had really difficult trying to figure out net, because this entire proposal is a lot of switches back and forth between and so forth. And, of course, we don't have a fiscal note necessarily that shows us kind of the net county. But, Mr. Allen, you've been in this so much. Can you give me sort of a feel of what the discussion's been like and what you think the net? I know counties don't like particular things that might be an impact, but on the other hand, there's things in here that looks like they saved them something as well. But as it currently stands, what do you view as the net financial impact to counties?
Chairman Bradley, across the proposal as a whole, because of the infrastructure investments, the proposal does put in out a lot of additional money into the mental health system. The maintenance of effort requirement and the managing of the transfer of responsibilities between health plans and counties, that was all handled in such a way that I think it's largely budget neutral. If you want to view the infrastructure grants as a bonus to the county, even though they're required, it's not, with a maintenance of effort requirement, not allowed to be used to offset any of the county costs that are there already. I think kind of if you kind of watch on the whole, unless you want to count the infrastructure grants as a bonus.
Anybody ready to vote? Any further discussion? I'm not sure I'm ready to vote.
Just a question on Section 7, which would be deleted here. If this section doesn't go into place, then the state would cover the whole cost of in the state-operated facilities. Is that right? This is trying to kind of correlate those 50% going both ways. And what's the current law?
Mr. Allen?
20%. Chairman Bradley, Representative Thiessen. Current law would have the counties paying no share of placements in community behavioral health hospitals. We saw that as problematic in that there would be no incentive when somebody who did not have insurance coverage was placed in one of those facilities, they'd be there free to the county, and there wouldn't be any incentive to move them out into the community.
And Mr. Chair, the counties make that decision? Who makes that decision?
Chairman Bradley, Representative Thiessen, under current law, counties are responsible for mental health services for the uninsured.
And Mr. Lieber, when you were explaining it about that the county shouldn't be responsible for spending where they have no choice, I resonated with that, but Section 7 doesn't seem to be that. It seems like the county's made the choice to place. And why would that be removed in the sort of a theme that you have?
Mr. Chair, this is kind of a work in progress, and I hope we can adopt the part that we agree that this is going to be laid over and we'll be talking about it some more. Maybe the county's going to talk about a specific point. Maybe they should bear a part of their share. But in many cases, there are simply no community resources anywhere to go. And in fact, that's one of the issues with the mental health beds in the hospitals, the inpatient emergency beds, where there is no place to send them. And then they backed up into the, heard that testimony. So that's the best I can. Am I helping or making it worse, Mr. Chair?
Hang on a sec. I think, first of all, Mr. Allen, and then we'll go. Representative Thiessen, Representative Goodwin.
Chairman Bradley, just to clarify, the lines 1.2 and 1.3 would include the community behavioral health hospitals in Section 6. And so for placement of uninsured persons in those hospitals, the counties would be paying 20% for the first 60 days and then 50% thereafter unless one of these conditions was met.
Just merging the two.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes, and then just to the point of the amendment, when the department put these provisions in its original bill, the intention was to create incentives. It was not primarily around monetary value. And so by holding these two exceptions, I think is consistent with the intent that we've had.
Representative Goodman, I think you had that up earlier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Allen,
I would like to get a correction or at least a clarification on one thing you said, and that's that current, under current law, counties are responsible for mental health coverage. I think what the statute, maybe Mr. Chen can correct me if I'm wrong here, says is that only to the extent that they're able to, which is why we have 87 different mental health systems in the state of Minnesota. So they are not obligated to do this if they say they don't have the ability to do it. Is that, am I wrong on that?
Mr. Allen?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, in the Mental Health Act, yes, there is the fiscal limitations provision. There also is counties are more obligated on towards providing services to people who are SPMI and SCD. In this particular area, we are talking about people who are under commitment, and that's another level of obligation for the counties under the Commitment Act.
So, yes, a little more clarification. So, under this provision, if a person is committed to an institution, to a state institution, or any mental health care.
Mr.
The county has to cover 20% for the first 60 days, and then 50% thereafter. And is that a commitment to just a state institution or to any mental health inpatient treatments, or if the person doesn't have insurance, that is?
Chairman Bradley, Representative Goodwin, this section only applies to state place, state-operated services places.
Well, Mr. Chair, one final. I mean, I'm kind of concerned then that this will do just the opposite of what your intention is, since there is this loophole in law that counties only have to pay if they can fiscally or financially afford to do it. And now we're saying they have to pay 20% for the first 60 days and 50% thereafter. The inclination would be to not give people the treatment that they needed or not commit them through the county judicial system to treatment if the county had to pay for it. So I'm afraid that there's going to be a lot more people that aren't going to get mental health care under that provision.
Mr. Allen?
Chairman Bradley, Representative Goodwin. I keep thinking of my commissioner.
You look like.
Please proceed.
This section, when persons are committed, that's under a different statute than the Mental Health Act, and those fiscal limitations do not apply. And so counties are responsible for these costs and cannot avoid them.
Representative Beeson. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Allen, if the counties are responsible, then also in this bill we're transferring the case management responsibility to the health plans. So how can we hold the counties responsible for the money but take away their direct control of case management?
Mr. Allen?
Representative Bradley, Chairman Bradley, Representative Huntley, under the proposal that we are doing, if a person is a health plan responsibility, then the health plan is responsible for the cost of the care. Okay. These provisions only apply to persons without insurance coverage, either in a private plan or a public health plan, who are a county responsibility. The county would be retaining case management responsibility.
Thank you. Any further discussion amongst members? And then before us is Amendment AO6-1414X as amended. All those in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? Amendment is adopted.
Or I've been known aid.
I believe we have another amendment in our folder. Was somebody offering that?
Did you have none?
I'm done.
Well, Mr. Chair, I had the A3 amendment.
Captain Huntley moves the A3 amendment.
And basically what this amendment does is say that if the health plans are making money on these on this program that 10% of that profit will have to be returned to the counties. What I'm concerned about is that if there is a profit on these, that that will be spread over the health plans other areas and into the, I mean, the health plan's gonna, if they make money, this goes into their reserves, and are they going to use that then to make up for shortfalls in their commercial market? So this simply looks at these programs for the mentally ill and tries to make sure that, that we understand that this is a special program, and it's somewhat different than what the health plans do with their commercial lines of work. And Mr. Chair, if you want to talk about profit, one of the PMAP counties, South Country, or county-based purchasing, I heard a testimony actually close to Duluth that and I don't remember which year it was, but they had about $50 million in that came in, and that they then paid out some of that to providers, but they had a $7 million profit. And in the case of county-based purchasing, about a 14% profit, at least for that year. In terms of what the county did with that, then they simply took that $7 million and put it back into services to the same group of people. Now, my question is, are the health plans, if they have a profit like that, what are they going to do with that money? Are they going to return it to the taxpayers? Are they going to return it to the counties? Or are they going to spread that money over their commercial market as well? And having said that, before the health plans come up and testify, Mr. Chair, I'd withdraw my amendment.
Let's save this some time. President Huntley withdraws the amendment. In no further discussion, Representative Emmer renews his motion. Well, I guess the chair will hold over House File 3630 as amended for possible inclusion.
This is a work in progress. Yes.
Chair is tempted to say we're adjourned just to see what the reaction would be.
I support that, Mr. Chair.
You will get lost even more.
Well, members, I don't think we can avoid doing our jobs, and we've got to move on to doing our job. Representative Powell has House File 2810. Would you like to move your bill, Representative Powell?
Mr. Chairman, I move that House File 2810 be recommended to pass and placed on general register.
Representative Powell moves House File 2810 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Just as a matter of ground rules, we've allowed for 15 minutes of testimony for proponents and opponents. My suggestion would be, to any extent that you can be efficient in your time, it would certainly be in your best interest. I know that this is a complicated topic, so we're allowing for that time. First, we'll begin with the proponents, and I'll just allow you to introduce yourselves as you begin. Senator Paul?
Mr. Chairman, will the question and answer period be after both sides?
We will wait until we receive all the testimony before we begin committee discussion, unless there's a clarification in the testimony.
Very good, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members, this simple bill has caused quite a bit of discussion this session. Much of the conversation has centered around quality of care and the desirability of introducing market forces in the delivery of radiation oncology. Both arguments, in my opinion, are a bit off target. First of all, I want to stipulate that MOPA physicians provide an outstanding quality of care. They have grateful patients. On the other hand, I will also stipulate that MRO also provides outstanding care for their patients. But then again, so does the oncologists at the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic. Quality here, I don't believe, is the issue. What the issue is centers around the idea that we have a market here. What we have is a highly regulated healthcare system. Government, both at the state and federal levels, has set the parameters at which facilities such as hospitals can operate. Consequently, the hospitals in the state of Minnesota are free to compete with each other, but only on a very narrow playing field. Some may wish that the situation was different, but it is what it is. The issue we are dealing with today must be dealt with in a manner that recognizes that the business plans of hospitals have been constructed in a manner that we, as legislators, have dictated to a great extent. To allow an entity to insert itself into this playing field, following different rules, only serves that entity, while causing great harm to the hospital facilities that we all count on in times of need. Hospitals cannot compete with this type of business plan whose ideas of integrated services only include the services that they feel that would be profitable to provide. For instance, the Merkel Clinic in Maplewood doesn't provide a complete cancer program. Neither do they operate an emergency room, or provide mental health beds, or deliver babies. These money-losing services and more are part of what full-service hospitals provide to the community. Indeed, it is the hospital that has the completely integrated program of services. Over the past two budget cycles, we have cut hospital reimbursements time and again. We are seeing increasing amounts of uncompensated care and charity care. Despite these circumstances, our hospitals continue to provide world-class health care to our citizens, largely due to the fact that they have some profit centers that allow them to cross-subsidize their unprofitable ones. One of those profit centers, one of the very few profit centers, has been radiation oncology. Now, members, to conclude, what this bill would do is to require physician groups to partner with hospitals, MOPA, MRO, or other physician groups can then compete with each other to contract for services with the hospital provider. That would be a level playing field. And Mr. Chairman, committee members, I have with me Mr. Lawrence Massa from Wilmer Hospital and Dr. Samuel Carlson from Methodist to continue on with our presentation.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourselves as you begin your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lawrence Massa, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer at Rice Memorial Hospital in Wilmer. In December of 2005, I completed my year serving as the Board Chair of the Minnesota Hospital Association, and I'm here today testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association and our 134 members. I'm here to express our strong support for House File 2810, a bill that would remove the 2008 sunset from the current statutory language regarding construction of new radiation facilities in Minnesota. The law has encouraged collaborative relationships and projects between hospitals and physicians that are high quality, cost-effective, and have introduced the latest technology to Minnesotans seeking treatment for cancer. This collaborative approach is good public policy that allows these services to be developed in the most cost-effective way for patients, physicians, and hospitals. Radiation technology is one of the most expensive investments made in healthcare. Patients are best served when that technology is provided in partnership, where hospitals and physicians can share precious resources and maximize efficiencies. This is accomplished without charging patients or government payers more than non-hospital settings. This issue has been discussed for several years in Minnesota, and the language passed in 2003 has not halted new cancer treatment development or stifled innovation, as some had feared. Minnesota has many fine physicians providing various cancer treatment therapies, and hospitals have good working relationships with many physician practices. The language has not resulted in an unfair advantage for one physician group over another. The law itself does not specify the nature of the collaboration or dictate the percentage ownership relationship. Hospitals can negotiate and partner with physician groups to construct an agreement that is mutually beneficial, or hospitals can pursue offering radiation therapy alone. The law is short and obviously not very prescriptive, but still a great benefit to hospitals. Let me explain the situation in Wilmer from a patient's perspective and from a hospital financing perspective. We have provided radiation therapy services on-site at Rice Memorial Hospital since 1986. We do this in partnership with two different physician groups, our local clinic, affiliated community medical centers, which offers medical oncology, and Minneapolis Radiation Oncology has a subsidiary organization that's based in our community. We serve a regional need. We treat patients from as many as 75 miles away. The nearest facilities are in St. Cloud, which also has a satellite in Alexandria, Sioux Falls, South Dakota to our southwest, Mankato and Waconia to the east and to the south. In Wilmer, we have a strong collaborative relationship with affiliated community medical centers, our community multi-specialty physician group, where medical oncology and chemotherapy services are available. Together, we have developed a cancer program that is accredited by the American College of Surgeons Commission on Cancer, no small undertaking in a rural community like Wilmer. We're currently discussing the potential of further integrating our services through a joint venture arrangement. I believe this is an excellent example of the type of collaboration encouraged by the current statute, and I fear the kind of collaboration we would see less of if the law is allowed to sunset. If the law were not in place and separate independent physician-owned radiation facilities were built in Wilmer, they would pull patients away from the hospital facility and duplicate costs. The equipment is expensive and a certain volume is needed to help pay for the investment. Having two competing facilities in Wilmer would result in neither facility being able to maintain a high enough patient utilization to remain viable and for us to offer the wide range of cancer services and other services that we provide in our community. This would not be in the best interest of our hospitals or our patients. Under the competitive model, hospitals would likely have larger volumes of uninsured and Medicare patients. Hospitals would also lose out on ancillary revenues from other services like imaging and diagnostic tests that are often associated with cancer treatment. Hospitals provide many services that receive reimbursements that are less than the cost of providing those services, such as mental health, emergency care, hospice, hemodialysis, and many others, just to name a few. Hospitals are often financially dependent on revenues generated from surgical procedures and other procedures that come from areas where there is a positive margin, and radiation oncology is certainly one of those areas. The cooperative model that this law encourages allows hospitals to continue to provide these wide array of services. I hope my comments today illustrate to you the importance of this bill to Minnesota hospitals, and I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Massa, does the Hospital Association have a position on out-of-hospital surgery centers and out-of-hospital imaging centers and other out-of-hospital chemotherapy clinics?
Mr. Massa?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, we have in the past proposed legislation that would try to level the playing field for some of those independent services with hospitals. We were not successful in that attempt a couple of years ago, but we think that there needs to be a leveling of playing field for all of those types of services.
Thank you. Please proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Bradley and committee members. I appreciate the chance to testify in favor of this bill. I'm Dr. Sam Carlson, a physician who practiced in internal medicine for 27 years before becoming chief medical officer of Park Nicollet and Methodist Hospital 4 years ago. Park Nicollet employs 8,000 individuals, 630 physicians, and have Methodist Hospital as our community hospital. The role of the community hospital has been well explained. We must take all comers. We have little option of choice, and part of our mission is to care and provide for those in our community. We have 40% of our patients paid for by government payer programs. In 2004, that resulted in a $12 million low-cost factor for our hospital. And in 2005, the non-government programs was a deficit of $25 million. The only way we can continue to provide care for the communities that we serve is to have some services for which margins are generated. And those margins support the care that all of you are familiar with. It's in Park Nicholas case and Methodist case, we have supplied materials for you which emphasize some of our activities and our community clinics, our free clinics, our school clinics, home care, pastoral care, mental health services, hospice, programs for stroke and HIV disease and many others. Now, you may hear that outcomes may be superior in independent facilities, and I would state very clearly that it's not true. We have excellent outcomes everywhere in Minnesota. Methodist Hospital actually began the tumor registry program in the upper Midwest, and I can show you data that shows superior performance, if you wish. You may hear that there's already a collaboration across this area, and there is to a degree, but there's a real difference between professional participation, which is a requirement for membership on hospital service, and true collaboration that supports the economic vitality of a precious community resource such as a hospital. You might also hear that if an outpatient or separate radiation therapy facility doesn't succeed, that there's no cost to that. But they clearly would succeed, and I'll explain why in just a moment. You may also hear that patients want choice. Well, we know as physicians that patients mostly go where we advise them to go. And if I'm an owner in a very profitable piece of equipment, won't I advise them to have it done in my place? MOPA employs 30 of 75 medical oncologists in the cities. That's 40% of the referrals that are potentially controlled by that organization. This is not about patient choice. This is about choosing dire consequences for community hospitals. You might also hear it's about access, but there really is no shortage of radiation therapy capacity in the cities. Of the 18 facilities here, 10 of them have excess capacity currently. And you might also hear that it's not about free market. Well, in a free market, you would choose not to care for segments of your business that are not profitable. And we would not and could not choose to do that as a community hospital. I would also ask us to consider what the impact of this would be on the critical relationship that patients have with their physicians. Radiation therapy equipment is real expensive, and the margins associated with it are considerable. We can't undo all the abnormal incentives that threaten healthcare reform, but we can keep one from aggravating this problem. Having patients, especially our most vulnerable patients, see that their physicians' decisions are not encumbered by economic motivations is critical for physicians to continue to have an effective function as healers. I think I'd ask each of you to put yourselves in a position of vulnerability with a physician where you're trusting that all decisions are made for the right reasons. If our patients perceive that our motivation for recommending or choosing a particular treatment is influenced by our own economic incentives around that treatment, the nature of the healing relationship starts to unravel. And this is a very bad thing. So in conclusion, a failure to pass this bill is bad for community hospitals, and it is bad for the broad communities we serve. Community hospitals provide unique services that freestanding groups do not. Quality of care is not an issue as evidenced by data. A collaborative approach is an essential component of healthcare cost containment. There is no shortage of capacity in this area. It's not about access. And to the extent that this legislation supports the integrity of the physician-patient relationship, it is good for all physicians and all patients. It's not about choice. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Does that exhaust the proponent testimony?
Mr. Chairman, we're done.
Okay. Representative, did you have a clarification question?
For one of the two, whoever can answer it, if you could stay for a second. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
As I said, I don't want to get into this debate kind of thing, but this clarification. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your testimony was in regards to the need for us to keep the facilities working with the hospitals because of the hospital's ability to I mean, essentially make more money off that part of their business. So I have two questions. Actually, I guess the first question is just specific to the bill. All the bill does is deletes the sunset. Why do we need to do it today? The sunset is 2008. If one of you could answer that.
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we want to be proactive about this, and so we've chosen to come to the legislature at this time to engage in this debate. I think 2008 is right around the corner when it comes to legislative activity, from our point of view.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is in regards to the testimony, you know, not exactly into response to the specific of the bill, but you stated the relationship of the hospitals and the MRO facilities or the doctor groups. Can you quickly, from my understanding, explain to me the relationship of hospital-owned equipment and leasing it out to the MRO group, hospital-owned buildings leased out, or does MRO own the building? Can you explain to me the relationship of who owns what?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe there are multiple models throughout the state of Minnesota. In our case, in Wilmer, MRO is an independent physician group that has a professional association in Wilmer. The hospital owns the equipment. They participate as members of our medical staff and use our equipment and direct the care of patients in radiation, but we own the equipment. They bill for their professional services. We bill for the technical component. I believe there are other arrangements where MRO and maybe other physician groups lease facilities from hospitals or other arrangements where they may actually own the equipment but lease the space from the hospital. So I think you see all types of arrangements that have evolved over time.
Perhaps we'll turn a little bit to that issue in the further discussion. Thank you again for your testimony. We now have those wishing to speak against the bill today. And if you come as a group or however you wish, I guess you can begin and proceed the order that I have or whatever order you wish. Welcome to the committee. And just introduce yourself as you begin so that we have that on record. Point.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to the committee. My name is Dr. Tom Flynn. I'm currently president of Minnesota Oncology Hematology PA, which is a private practice physician group here in the greater metropolitan area, made up exclusively of cancer specialists who provide care for cancer patients in this part of the state. Mention has been made of integrated model of cancer care, and we do sincerely believe that this is the best way to deliver care for our patients. We have medical oncologists, radiation oncologists, and gynecologic oncologists all in one practice. At our Maplewood Cancer Center, which we believe is the model of care that should be pursued, we have medical and radiation oncologists there on site. This provides for a lot of convenience for patients. It provides for easier access from the physical perspective. Patients can drive up to the front door and walk in a short distance and be in the facility and get all of their care there. All of the services are under one roof. Chemotherapy, radiation, imaging, and pharmacy. And all the personnel are focused on cancer care and the special needs of the cancer care patient. You heard about other types of services that are provided in hospital facilities. We have patient advocates, we have a social worker, and we have a dietitian who help provide those sorts of ancillary services to our patients. We have a charitable foundation, not-for-profit foundation, that our physicians established in 2001. We are very proud of that. It is supported in large part by individual donations from our physicians and provides additional services to our patients outside the realm of medical care in terms of support programs, educational programs, and actually financial support to patients who are in need because of their cancer diagnosis and treatment in the form of coupons for the grocery store and reimbursement for living expenses. This model of coordinated care is one that has been studied. And I have a study here which I would like to distribute to the members of the committee, done in a center in California, which looked at outcomes, specifically survivals of cancer patients for a period of several years prior to and then a period of several years subsequent to the establishment of an integrated facility, and they found that their outcomes actually were improved. The existing legislation, I think, puts the hospitals in a specific position that is different from the private practice groups. A lot of discussion was provided around the need for collaboration, and we believe strongly in collaboration as well. But the legislation as written provides the hospital with the opportunity to do what they feel is best and can choose or not choose to collaborate with physicians. We have only the opportunity to collaborate if the hospital agrees to do so. A new facility was built here in St. Paul recently by Regents Hospital in spite of this legislation, and that is only a matter of several blocks from two other radiation facilities in the city of St. Paul at United Hospital and St. Joseph's. As I said, we work with hospitals, we support hospitals, we collaborate with hospitals and have always done so and will always continue to do so. And we admit patients, we help direct and enhance their cancer programs, we serve as medical directors, we chair cancer committees, we assist hospitals in attaining accreditation for their cancer programs from national accrediting organizations. We obviously see patients in the hospital, do consultations at the hospital on patients with cancer diagnoses. Our GYN oncologists perform surgery in several hospitals several times a week. We have physicians on call for patients, for the hospitals, for the ERs, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We are in the final stages of an agreement with the hospital to partner on an integrated cancer facility and are pursuing discussions with others as we move forward. We have no plans or intentions to go out and to compete with outstate rural hospitals. We have never sought legislation to coerce another group or entity to do their approach to care in a particular way. Over 80% of cancer care is delivered in community outpatient settings. There isn't, in my mind, a reason to say that the hospitals have to be the ones to determine when and where that care might be best delivered. We serve a diverse group of patients from all economic and ethnic groups. For example, we have 350 patients who are members of the Hmong community. We provide substantial amounts of uncompensated care. And we have a substantial portion of our practice which is also reimbursed through governmental payers, just as the hospitals do. This is about patient access and choice. It's about choice of what kind of facility they wish to receive their care at this very difficult time. And there is a convenience factor of a freestanding facility that doesn't require the patient to negotiate, particularly in a metropolitan area. What is often a large and complicated facility. I practice at Abbott Northwestern, where I've been since 1987, and I think it took me a couple of years to figure out where everything was in that facility. Over 60% of our patients currently in our practice who need radiation therapy receive that therapy in facilities other than our own. Patients are referred for radiation treatment to whatever facility they prefer or they find convenient. We did an analysis of this a couple of years ago. Over 90% of our patients that are seen at our Minneapolis office, which is in the Abbott Northwestern campus, and our Fairview Southdale office, which is on that campus, receive the radiation therapy at those hospital facilities, not at our facility. I think, as I said, it does come down to convenience, coordination of care, and as shown in that study I distributed, the potential for better outcomes for patients. I will turn it over now to a cancer survivor who would like to provide you with her perspective.
You're welcome to the committee. If you'd begin by introducing yourself as well.
Thank you, yes. Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Michelle Stengel, and I am a MOPA cancer patient. May I say that my testimony this morning is entirely written by myself. I appear before you as I feel a fresh perspective, not wearing a suit, not having any business motives or cancer care motives, except that I am a fresh initiate into living with cancer. My 11-year-old nephew, Nevin, assures me Saturday that my hair looks good. He loves all animals, and he says, yes, you look like a muskrat now. Whether that's an improvement over last month's hedgehog, I leave to you to decide. I'm humbled to have... Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
I'm humbled to have your attention this morning as a fresh initiate into living with cancer. I grew up in Virginia, Minnesota. I graduated from St. Scholastica in Duluth, and after graduation accepted a position here in St. Paul, and that's as far south as I got. The Twin Cities have been my home since 1976. I'm employed by the Minnesota Department of Corrections, where for 14 years it has been my privilege to serve the taxpayers of this great state. My husband, John, is a devoted high school and college teacher, beloved by his students and their parents. We've been married 25 years. 15 months ago, an ordinary afternoon quaked when I heard the words breast, cancer, chemotherapy, positive lymph node, and my name in the same sentence. I spent 6 hours in surgery. I completed 4 months of chemotherapy last June. The care and treatment I received at MOPA, a community-based cancer center, compelled me to be here this morning to ask you to vote no on limiting the choice of cancer patients to receive our care in a full-service cancer setting. I am here before you living with cancer with a grateful heart because of the people that are MOPA. I chose my physicians initially. I chose my care on a continued basis throughout. And may I say, a previous physician / administrator spoke here, at no time did my doctor decide that I needed chemotherapy because it would be lucrative for their practice. At no time did my dear physician dictate where I should consider receiving my chemotherapy services. In fact, she never mentioned it. Did I shop around as you would? I hope, my friends. You bet I did. And when I didn't like what I saw at MOPA, Maplewood Cancer Care Center, I traveled downtown to their St. Paul location, and I also checked out not one but two hospital facilities in the metro area, and I made my choice. Is that important? You better believe it when it's cancer and it's you and it's your family. I am disturbed that my state government, respectful committee members, would consider limiting that choice as being a patient in the healthcare business. Do you look forward to doctor appointments? My unbelievable answer is yes, I have for the past year. Why? I'm okay. I am a person, not a patient. I am greeted by name. Tammy or Ann would smile at me, reach behind the desk to grab my chart without asking who I was and who I was there to see. They wouldn't comment on my current wig of the day, my wig du jour, I called it. I visited a familiar person, not a department. I see Mary at Maplewood MOPA for my PET scans, not a radiology department. I get hugs from nurses and look forward to continue interesting conversations with the same caregivers. Heidi, my dietitian, follows up an hour consultation with me, encouraging me and saying I'm doing great, and encouraging me to call if I have any more questions. And what I call the good neighbor policy that assures me continuity of care, not fully granted. And quality care, yes, very definitely quality care. As an example, I applied for a routine injection the day after chemo treatment, reporting what seemed to me a minor symptom. My nurse recognized the seriousness and walked across the hall to discuss this personally with my doctor. I did not have to leave the office that day and drive to my doctor on a very exhausting emotional day. Why? Because my nurse and my physician are good neighbors under the same shingle roof. My chemo side effects were handled that moment, and I avoided a certain hospital admission without this impromptu, unscheduled intervention. This is the reality of living through cancer treatment. I continued being independent and feeling pretty normal by choosing to take a city bus to my downtown chemotherapy appointments because of the location in the community. Convenience? Oh, it does matter. I sat down for my PET x-ray scans with Mary at a convenient mobile location on my way to work. In conclusion, the question to ask yourself, please, is what is best for the patient? I will be honored if you put my face and story to mind this morning as you consider this legislation. Thank you.
Well, Ms. Engel, not only thank you for your testimony, but thank you for your courage, and God bless you.
Thank you.
Mr. Stein, Renner?
We have about 2 minutes left here, so accordingly.
Mr. Chair and members, Dave Venner with the Minnesota Medical Association. I will reference you to a letter that's in your packet from our current president, Dr. David Lear. I will try to be brief, stay within your time limits. I should make it very clear that the MMA is not here to support MOPA or to oppose MRO. As Representative Powell said, I think both the groups do a remarkable job in the work that they do. Our opposition to this legislation is based on principles we've looked at, looking at the overall issues of supply in the healthcare area. We have adopted a number of principles. Let me just highlight three quickly. Number one, we would say the principal driving force behind any development should be the health of Minnesotans, the health of the community. Number two, we have a policy that states that the state public policy should encourage, not stifle, innovation in healthcare delivery. Currently, we still are somewhat based on a competitive system. Many of the procedures that are offered today in outpatient settings only a few years ago were only done in hospitals, and we think that's an improvement. Provides a more efficient, less costly, more convenient care to patients. It's unclear to us how mandating that these facilities only be owned by hospitals would do anything to ensure appropriate growth of new facilities or impact quality. The final principle that we have does state that collaborative models should first be explored. We think it is always better if physicians and institutions explore ways to work together. However, that principle also goes on to say that ownership or investment in a healthcare facility by any one entity should not be restricted, nor should it be required. By simply mandating a specific arbitrary investment ownership requirements, we think that does limit innovation. I just want to remind you all that all stakeholders in any facility expansion discussion respond to financial incentives. Any attempts from one side to claim that it's more altruistic in its motivations than the other, we would argue, should be is somewhat suspect. The entity proposing new delivery models is responding to financial incentives that they think they can provide services better and that they will be successful. The entity opposing new delivery models is also responding to financial incentives that they believe will negatively impact their ability to provide those services. With that, Mr. Chair and members, I just again would state that we don't think House File 2810 provides any better ways to control the expansion, and we would ask you to oppose the legislation.
Thank you for your testimony. Griffin Dean, did you have a clarification question, or were you ready? Okay, all right. Well, thank you for testimony. That concludes testimony. Sure, Griffin Powell.
Mr. Rayner, last year we changed the bill to the law to today's current form. I don't remember. Did you guys have a position? The AMA, MMA have a position on the current law last time when we had the debate?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Powell, yes, matter of fact, it was not last year. I think it was 3 or 4 years when we passed the legislation to put in the current language. We did oppose that language, that legislation at that time as well.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I think we're now open for discussion. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a very important discussion because it kind of goes to the heart what a lot of the committee deals with, which is dealing with the healthcare services that we provide and how we pay for that, and to the extent that it's a free market and not a free market. And I want to first just say that the hospitals are in a very, very difficult position, and they every year probably gets worse with uncompensated care mandates and liability. And we need to do more to help the hospitals stay in business and to thrive and to work in partnerships. I just think that this particular provision is probably the way to go at this time. And I think the competition between the clinics and the hospitals is very interesting. Dr. Carlson, you had a comment that said, you said, and I quote, with regard to the MOPA facility, if I have an expensive machine, won't I advise that the patient use that in my place? Couldn't the same argument be said for the hospitals? And how would you respond to that?
Dr. Carlson.
Yes, certainly. The hospitals are not-for-profit institutions, so the margins that are generated from those services, which can generate a margin, simply flow to the bottom line. And we are accountable from that bottom line to provide direct benefit to the community through capital improvements, improvements in the capabilities and training of our staff and service, and that sort of thing. So the margin that we generate based on use of any of our services flows to the bottom line, not specifically a service or another. Is that sufficient?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Carlson, in your testimony, the predication was that this was, you have many, many places in your hospital where you lose money. You lose money in the ER, you lose money on uncompensated care, MA, patients, and so forth, and that this was highlighted as one of the areas that you can actually generate positive cash flow. So that, you know, wouldn't it also be a fair assumption that there is a benefit to keeping that in-house versus letting that particular service go to another facility that may be able to provide a higher level or a different service to the patient that might be more appropriate for their medical diagnosis?
Dr. Carlson.
Yes, Representative Dean. The hospital is not involved in the decision-making process about which treatment modalities are selected. That is made by the medical staff.
Thank you, Dr. Carlson.
And Representative Dean.
Just to kind of close on that, I think that there is obviously competition between the two, and we need to look for ways to find more coordination in the future. However, I think the testimony of Ms. Stengel kind of points to the what sways me in this debate, which is the patients going through a very difficult time having the services under one roof. I think in the debate, which is economics and referral and competition, that quality piece sways me, and that's how I'll be voting today. Thank you.
Representative Putley.
Mr. Chair, I really don't have any questions, but just a few comments. It's clear to all, I think all of us know, that this is not an issue of quality and outcomes of the health care. And it's not an issue of overuse of the medical system, because nobody's going to refer anybody to radiation oncology or to chemotherapy simply to make money. Obviously, that would never happen. We've heard about self-referral, and Dr. Flynn said that only 40% of the MOPA patients are referred inside the network. 60% are referred outside to get the radiation therapy. So I don't think self-referral is a problem with this system. We've talked about competition. I was informed by one of the people that are representing MRO that, well, now that one of their groups said a new facility in a hospital, but it was on the ground level so people could drive right up and go in, just like the MOPA facility. Well, why did they do that? They did that because they have to compete with MOPA to give the same kind of friendly, effective care in a easy setting for the patient that is really at a very hard point in their life. So I think that competition is starting to work. I think the hospital-based facilities are changing the way that they operate. And I think that's good. Normally, I'd be on the other side of this issue because I'm always trying to get hospitals and docs consolidated into one group. But what bothers me about this is the big problems for hospitals in terms of somebody doing stuff outside is surgery centers and imaging centers. It's not radiation oncology. So why are we here picking on this one little part of the healthcare system to try to stop competition, supposedly to help hospitals? Well, I don't think it's my job specifically to help hospitals. My job is to help patients get the kind of care that they want and that they need in a cost-effective way. And I think that MOPA has come up with a really great system to take care of their patients. And I think the fact that they're here is changing the way the rest of that kind of healthcare is delivered in this city, because the rest of them have to keep up with what MOPA's doing. So why would we want to slow down MOPA when I think they're actually the leader in the kind of quality care that needs to be delivered to these patients? So I, again, am not going to support this bill.
Kristen Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I have a question probably both for Dr. Carlson and Dr. Flynn. And my question would be, I'm really interested in continuum of services. And Dr. Flynn talked about it a little bit, about things like a social worker, other ancillary services, a dietitian, I think what was mentioned. And I'm wondering if I can get the opinion of Dr. Carlson as how you feel MOPA does with these services, because I'm very interested in continuum of care and want to be assured that both locations, I guess, would provide the services. And then I guess my question would be for Dr. Flynn, do you feel that MOPA offers the same continuum of care services as the MRO with the hospital connection can?
Dr. Carlson, you first.
Yes, thank you, Representative Pepin. I believe that the cancer programs at hospitals do vary. And so I can really speak to Methodist Hospital's commitment to that particularly. We have a program that integrates both our cancer program in the outpatient and inpatient side. We have full support with social workers, pastoral care, nurse clinicians, dietary. We have cancer support groups that are integrated in the inpatient and outpatient side. Sometimes the individuals providing that service are the same. And so I believe that we do provide a comprehensive continuum of care that is unique to the hospital because of the breadth of resources that are potentially available.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Dr. Ben. I'm Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin. I outlined that we do have these broad spectrum of services available to our patients. I think that hospitals obviously have similar services in a different setting and organized in a somewhat different way. I think the advantage to our particular system of integrated care when it is all in one facility where all the staff, employees, professionals involved there are focused on the cancer patient and are experts in cancer care, that there is a particularly special way that that service can be provided, and so that the patient advocate and the social worker and the dietitian are all spending virtually all their time with cancer patients and not with other types of patients throughout a hospital setting. So there's a greater focus on the cancer patient. There's a greater development of expertise around their particular needs.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Flynn, thank you. So would you say that your services are equal for these to MRO. I know Dr. Carlson talked about pastoral care, cancer support groups, and things like that. Could you just go into a little bit more detail on that? I'm just trying to get a kind of a sense if it has the same comprehensive services as MRO, and it didn't exactly match up.
So who are you directing?
Dr. Flynn.
Dr. Flynn.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't have an emergency room, but we have doctors on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to administer to patients who need emergency care. I can't comment directly on the services provided by Park Nicollet. I don't practice there, and I don't have any direct personal experience with their facility. And I don't think it's an issue of quality. I think it's an issue of how the care is delivered, what the focus is, and how that's all coordinated. So, as I said, we have the patient advocate, social worker, the dietitian. We obviously do work with hospitals if there are other kinds of services patients need. We have the foundation, which provides for support groups and education programs and financial assistance to patients who need it. Does that help?
Could I perhaps clarify that as well? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. MRO is a contracted provider with Methodist Hospital, so they provide the radiation therapy services at Methodist Hospital. But it is Methodist Hospital which provides the coordinated and integrated care model. One other aspect is the hospice program, which is a component of inpatient care of the terminally ill, as well as an outpatient program, and that also is integrated within the hospital system, both in the inpatient and outpatient side.
Thank you.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I have a question, but before I get to it, I just want to comment, Representative Huntley, that I really get a kick out of this process because it's days like today that really give me encouragement about the future when I hear folks like yourself talking about freedom and competitive markets. And, normally I would have been on the other side of this issue, and it's an amazing bright ray of sunshine that is bleeding through somewhere. That being said,
okay, now that you've sucked up enough.
The but is this. These regulations were created, and I've had a problem with this since I came here, because I think we had a hospital argument last year about we need to just lift these moratoriums and let the marketplace work. But the more I get into it, you know, it was I think it was primarily your side of the aisle back in the early 90s that put many of these regulations in, and the reason that the regulations were enacted was to try and make the marketplace more competitive. Whether we agree with them or not, we have to remember that most of those are gone, by the way. Most of those regulations that were enacted, I understand, in the early 1990s are gone. And they're no different than our antitrust laws, which seek to make sure that we can protect a free marketplace. The problem that we're having here is that this is not a free marketplace. And I'll just, there are four conditions that must be met in order for a market to be considered perfectly competitive, which is what I understood your remarks were. This is about competition. The first one is that consumers must have access to information that allows them to compare price and quality, and information must be equally available to buyers and sellers. We don't have that.
Right.
We don't have that at all here. Second, the product or service being sold must be uniform so that if price and quality were the same, customers would be indifferent about which seller they choose to buy from. We don't have that either here. Third, there must be many buyers and sellers in the market. Well, I think the reason we're here is because we don't have that. We got a lot of buyers, but we don't have a whole lot of sellers. And the reason we need to have a lot of that is so that individual buyers can actually affect the market. Well, that's never going to happen under the system of healthcare that we have in Minnesota. And I've been wrestling with it, and I have no idea what I'm going to do. As I continue to listen to the discussion, but We don't have a free marketplace. So really the issue is, based on the marketplace that we have, how do we protect the services best for the consumer? Those are the people that you're concerned about when you were referencing in your remarks, you're worried about the patient. How do we make sure that we protect that for the patient at the lowest possible cost for the people that actually are paying it, all of us, in the end? And I guess my question when it comes to MOPA, is when I went back and started to look at all this stuff, when MOPA, and this is the question for whoever's out there that can answer it probably from the department, is apparently MOPA came into this regulated marketplace, like it or not, came into this regulated marketplace and took the position that they're outside of our laws and it's their right to give us what they want to give us when they feel like giving it to us in terms of information. And I'm wondering, because I think that was in the late 1990s, and I'm sure it's been resolved by now, but whatever happened with that? They were one of, I think, Medicare and MOPA were both the only two that were ever put on prospective review or something of that nature. Whatever happened with that? Did they ever satisfy the state in terms of the information that was required so that we understand exactly what they were doing in the marketplace?
After that specific question, Dr. Flynn, can you respond to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it was in 1998. There was some difference of opinion about what data was required to be provided. The commissioner, as I understand at the time, ultimately ruled that MOPA would be under prospective review because adequate information had not been provided in what they considered a timely fashion. There was actually never any ruling on the merits of whether the facility was appropriate or inappropriate. So we were under prospective review for 5 years as per the statute at the time.
Any follow-up, Representative, does that answer your question?
I don't know that it does. So there was never any, Mr. Chairman, I guess for the witness, is there somebody from the department here that could tell us how they resolved it?
Like some seconds, yeah?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Scott Leish from the Minnesota Department of Health. The history on the MOPA prospective review, there was a period of time where MOPA, the department learned that of the Maplewood facility being constructed in close proximity to an existing facility. Information was requested about that. The department never received sufficient information for us to actually make a ruling as to whether the MOPA facility that was constructed was appropriate, which is the language of the statute 62J17, the capital expenditure reporting law. And so at the time, Commissioner Berry at that point did place MOPA under prospective review for a period of 5 years, and that period of prospective review ran out 5 years hence from the time of the prospective review order, which would have been sometime in the year 2003.
Mr. Nimmer?
Mr. Likes, I'm reading from a report to the legislature back in 2003, February 2003, from a joint task force on healthcare costs and quality, and it's been represented that there was a dispute or a misunderstanding. What it says here is that MDH asked for additional information regarding the relationship between MOPA and U.S. Oncology. MOPA refused to provide the information requested by the department. It doesn't say anything past that when I read the report if that information was ever provided to the department. It does say that in 2003, the period, I mean, it's a probationary period is what it looks like, but it's called prospective something, that was lifted. And my question is, was that information ever provided to the department?
Mr. Reitz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, the department did subsequently receive some information from MOPA and U.S. Oncology. It was after the prospective review order had been put in place. The department at that point did not reconsider the order at that time because the order was in place. I would have to go back and look at that information. Frankly, I haven't looked at it for some period of time to know exactly what was contained in that information, but we did receive some information subsequent to the order for prospective review.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, that to me is very important to what I'm being asked to look at today, and I certainly would like to know, because these are public meetings, so if I offend somebody, that's just the chance I take. and a regular occurrence, I understand. But for me, if there's some history of we're coming into this marketplace and we're just going to do what we're going to do, I'd like to know that before I'm asked to vote on lifting or removing this restriction to allow, as my colleague Representative Huntley would so desire, this competition in the marketplace. So I don't know if that's available.
Well, I think you've gotten probably as good as an answer you're going to be able to get for today anyway. And I am anxious to be sure that we get to a point of a chance to vote on this. Representative Goodman, and then Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like the list you read, Representative Emmer, of the things that the rules for competition, more or less, because I think you're right, those things are not happening in the healthcare field, and I think a number of them could be happening in the healthcare field. And unfortunately, I think that's what's brought us to where we're at. The issue, and Dr. Carlson thinks a lot of Methodist Hospital, and the work you're doing is phenomenal, but I'm also very concerned about the competition in healthcare and the need for more competition, the need for more patient information. And I'm concerned about the fact that you have to come here and try to stop somebody else from doing the same thing you're doing because your hospital depends financially on the services that you're providing. I think there's other ways of approaching that and reimbursement rates for other services, because what I see happening in the hospital system is that we're focusing on those areas of medicine that'll bring the most reimbursement, and the other areas of medicine that are just as important and sometimes much more prevalent need for are being overlooked or not fulfilled completely or patchworked. And I think that's happening in mental health, it's happening in chemical dependency, it's happening in a number of illnesses that aren't related to high reimbursement rates. So I don't really think this is the answer, and is to stop a competition. I think we need to encourage that, but we also need to take a real good look at our medical systems, and either we have universal health care or we have more competition. We have to try something different than what we're trying, and what we're trying is not working. You can have it the Republican way, or you can have it the Democratic way of making sure everybody gets health care, but what's happening right now is not working.
I'm sorry. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple thoughts. I think one thing we can agree on is if we're focusing on outcomes of patient care, all the folks that are at the table, the outcomes are good. So, and when we're talking about quality, I think that's what we ought to be focusing on. And I would note that the study that was handed out, that was a hospital-related facility. The integrated care model that cited here as quality, it was attached to a hospital.
A freestanding facility.
Nonetheless, connected with a hospital. The point, I guess, that's really compelling to me is two things. We need to talk about patient outcomes, but I also think as a legislature, our goal is to look at all patients. And I think one of the things we're hearing is that this is a way that we bring up the quality of care and the access to care for all patients, because our hospitals are hurting, and this is a way that we can get there. And so if we look at all patients instead of individual patients, perhaps, which is maybe what our job is, noting that the quality of outcomes, regardless of what path we choose, are going to likely be the same, I think that's a very compelling argument to say, this is one direction we should go. I would also note that if you look at the availability of the technology, and I've been reading a lot about technology, and that really is one of the critical cost drivers that we have in our system right now, that we keep investing in newer and newer and newer models for incremental advances in outcomes. And right now, we have a great overcapacity of these machines and there's an undercapacity of patients, in a sense, for these machines. They're not used to full capacity in our system, and I think one of the things that this law does is actually help control some of those exploding technological costs. And, so in the end, I think we aren't in a free market. I think that the policy that we passed several years ago has some very good incentives and controls on how on cost growth in our system, and so that's why I would support Representative Powell's bill.
Well, I wish it were that easy. I'm not so sure that in our current market, as you mentioned, Representative Emmer, that there aren't investments made at hospital levels to expand facilities that, I mean, I...
But, Mr. Chair, those don't go to profits to a multi-billion dollar company. They go to support non-profit hospitals.
Well, you and I may have a different view. Not-for-profit doesn't mean that there aren't some internal profits. Let's see, I think I saw a hand. Did you have a response, Dr. Carlson?
If I could, I am a strong proponent of competition in healthcare, but I think we should compete on things that we are level on, and such things as service, we should be able to compete on service. How well we delight our patients. We ought to be able to compete on outcomes and data on what our results are. And publicly reported data is important. That's what we should compete on. And we're committed to be competitive at that area. But being able to do so requires that we have the resources necessary to generate those efforts. And part of the fuel for those resources are margins from such technological services such as this. Thank you.
I think it's a point well made. Frankly, I wish we would fix the more underlying specific problem with those places that you're just mentioning, as opposed to sort of having to mask it by doing something relatively artificial in my market view of things. But I don't have an easy answer for that either. I understand some of the dynamics. Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll keep this short. We've heard a lot of concerns outlined. Cost, free market. I think what I keep coming back to, and Representative Huntley, a lot of you addressed it already, is quality of care, and quality of care is not the issue. Everyone that testified here made that point very well known. I asked the question earlier about why now with this bill, and we all heard that response. So to wrap that up, to wrap up what I'm trying to do here, Mr. Chair, is I have a DE1 amendment that will extend the sunset, and that will give us time. Representative Emmer pointed out lack of institutional knowledge. I'm trying not to offend you, Representative Emmer. But we've heard the debate, we've heard the concerns of committee members, and I just think there's a lot of questions out there. So I have the DE1 amendment, and
Representative Finstead offers the DE1 amendment. Representative Finstead, your amendment.
And Mr. Chair, if I could incorporate a change in the DE1 amendment.
Go ahead. Frank.
Line 1.8, if we could delete 2010 and insert 2013.
Representative Finstead will incorporate his amendment changing on line 1.8, 2010 to 2013. I have that correct, Representative Finstead?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further discussion to your amendment?
Just in closing, Mr. Chair, I just think this gives us the opportunity. I don't think this makes anybody happy, but this gives us the opportunity to fully study the issue and really get our hands around the competition, the hospital concerns, and provide opportunity then for us to address this at a later date.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative
We have had a very good discussion here on this, and a lot of give and take. I think both sides have acquitted themselves well on this. As for my part, this has never been personal. This has been something I've believed in, and that's why I took the bill. I do see that there's quite a bit of division amongst the committee, certainly amongst the providers, and I think it is a good compromise to be able to take Representative Finstead's amendment, set this out 5 years, and let things shake out a little bit more. So I would consider this a friendly amendment.
Representative Huntley, do you have
a roll call?
Roll call been requested. Representative Vogler?
Mr. Chair, maybe we're doing that. We should also make a friendly amendment using the Huntley amendment from the last bill and require that 10% of the lobbying and organizational fees rather than put this go to some worthy cause. I won't offer that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Roll call has been requested. Take the roll. And this was to the DE1 amendment as it was amended.
Bradley?
Yes.
Finstead?
Yes.
Aber?
Yes.
Dean?
Yep.
Eakin?
Yes.
Emmer?
Pass.
Goodwin?
No.
Huntley?
Yes.
Otremba?
Yes.
Pepin?
Yes.
Powell?
Yes.
Samuelson?
Yes.
Howe?
No.
Leeson?
Yeah.
Walker?
Yes.
Yes?
Yeah.
Wilkin?
Yes.
There being a whole bunch of ayes and some nays, vote was 13-2. The amendment does pass.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Davis?
I think for full disclosure, candidates filing for office in the state of Minnesota in the House of Senate should be warned this will come up again in probably 3 or 4 years.
You all can have fun with it. I'm going to be gone. Mr. Huntman?
Roll call on the final vote.
Okay, roll call has been requested in the final vote. I think we're ready to vote. Let's take the roll on the House File 2810 as amended.
Bradley?
Yes.
Hempstead?
No.
Abler?
Yeah.
Dean?
No.
Deacon?
Yes.
Hammer?
Pass.
Goodwin?
No.
Huntley?
No.
Otremba? Pepin?
Yes.
Powell?
Yes.
Samuelson?
Yes.
Tao?
Yes.
Leeson?
Yes.
Walker?
Yes.
Wilkin?
Yes.
There being 11 ayes and 4 nays, the motion is adopted. The bill will be sent on with a recommended pass to the General Register. Members, keep your Monday night and Tuesday nights next week open. We have a lot more bills, and we may need to meet on Monday night. We adjourn.